Following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Okay, welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Thank you for tuning in once again this morning. And before we get started, let's remind that just because you hear us talk about a strategy or an opportunity, this is not a DIY type program. And we would strongly encourage you to connect with your current advisors, be it tax, legal, real estate, etc., to discuss what you thought you heard, and feel free to call me if you want some clarification on my end, and let's make sure before you dive into the deep end that there's adequate water awaiting you, and it makes sense for your goals and objectives. And if you don't have advisors that understand real estate, private partnerships, retirement plan strategies for investing your funds in private partnership syndications involving multifamily, let me know, and we'll get some information from you. And in fact, you can go to our website to the link up at the second link from the right at the top of the Be a Planner Show, or no, just go to BAPlanner.com. Actually, either one of those links will work. And look for the forms link. And if you'll go to that page, then you can complete at least the first form. The client profile will give us enough information to have some idea of what your current facts and circumstances are. And then right after you submit that, go to the call link and set up a call, and I'll be happy to spend some time with you looking at that information and see, make a determination of how or if we might be able to work with you. And I'm going to suggest now, I mean, you know, we've been doing this for quite a while. I've consulted in this area for 20 plus years. It's painful to think about it, actually. And I've never seen a time, I mean, there's been some difficult times in that 20 plus years, but I've never seen a time now, or like we have now, where there's bad stuff going on in the industry, and it's filtering down to, you know, of everybody involved in the industry of real estate private partnership syndications, the passive partner, the capital partner, is the only one that seemingly doesn't have the protections in place that everybody else does. You know, the lender is protected. The lead partner, the syndicator, the sponsor, whatever term you like to use for that role, you can rest assured they have papered their operating agreement and their other documents, the PPM, with assorted fees to where they're going to get a huge chunk of compensation literally up front before there's been anything substantive realized by the partnership, and with no clawbacks in most cases. And then I'll tell you, the single biggest issue, and we'll spend some time on this later in the show today, is how they price the investment. For those of you that have invested in a syndication, I'm just curious, how much thought did you give? I mean, there's no market per se where you can look at a market for the investment that you're getting ready to make, or even something that's a duplicate, and say, well, they sold shares in that endeavor for X number of dollars, and how does that compare with the one you're investing in? I'll challenge you, it's difficult. It's difficult for us to pin down whether it's rational. I mean, we can, you know, that's about as far as we can go. Is this rational or irrational, given the pro forma information, given what you're being told you should expect to see coming back from that investment? You know, you're going to put $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 in, and you know, in most cases, and you expect to get back a number based on pro forma information. And I'm going to use the word again, expect. It's an expectation. It is not a guarantee of any kind. And for those of you that have invested in the past 2 or 3 years, you may be in a transaction that is yielded zero. I know I'm in one that to date has yielded zero, and it looks like it's effectively been terminated. And I got to tell you, it's not a good feeling, and I'm not sure that, you know, we know all the answers as to why that particular project ended up. I mean, the interest rate squeeze that so many lead partners went through is no doubt part of every failed project. But, you know, it's just, it's sad that quality projects and what I would call quality lead partners in some cases have had the wind taken out of their sails on projects that you would just not suppose would have a problem. Great locations in some cases, no good reason other than interest rates, and to the extent occupancy was an issue on a few that I've witnessed that clients are in. You know, I always hearken back to a comment that one of my clients made at one point. He was a big-time Houston commercial real estate broker, and we were talking one day about real estate in general, rental real estate, because he had invested with me in a couple transactions. And he was saying, you know, Nathan, he said, over the years, I've seen many, many pieces of real estate come along, and I don't think there's a better piece of real estate or a better looking piece of real estate than one that's got a rent paying tenant in it. And I think of that every time I see a property that's got below stable, what we're going to call stable occupancy, somewhere in the 92% to 95% range. And there's just something about being full, of course, at the right rates, that, you know, brings stability to a property. And without a stable recurring NOI, or net operating income, which starts at the top with the gross rental line, you're not going to be successful, or as successful. You may not go under, but you're not going to make money if you can't keep that property full. Anyway, for those of you, again, that don't have advisors to tear apart any syndications that you're looking at and give you maybe not what you want to hear, but what you need to hear, and point you in the right direction in terms of how to ask for the additional information, how to protect yourself. And that all has to happen before you've put the money into the transaction. You will not get any response that you like after you've given the lead partner your money. And I'm just telling you, if you're asking a question that causes some anxiety on the part of the lead partner or some, I don't know, let's just say anger, well, you need to know that now. Don't wait until it's too late to find out how much a lead partner resents your question. And, you know, the clawbacks, you got to have clawbacks these days. And I know there's not a lead partner in the world that will voluntarily do that, but there's ways. And okay, if it means you got to look at 20 deals to find one, great, look at 20 deals, because at least you'll have your money in a deal that's working theoretically, that if you just give it up to the first lead partner that says, oh yeah, we'd love to have you, and no, I'm not going to be paying back any of the significant upfront fees that I've taken, like acquisition fees, due diligence fees, capital raise fees, just go down the list, you know, refinance fees, property, or not property management, but construction management. Property management and asset management, those fees are commonplace across the board. They're always in the 5% range collectively. And I'm talking about the fees that are totally arbitrary, and again, it all has to do with pricing a deal. And I'm going to suggest to you there's a reason syndicators get promotes or overrides, and you really need to think hard if you're looking at a transaction where it's got a 20 to, I don't know, I see deals that have 50% promotes, or they scale up to that. They may start lower, but then at a certain point, after they've achieved a certain measure of return, be it an IRR or a cash on cash, then they scale up to where your share goes down as a group of passive investors and the syndicator's share goes up. And, you know, you really need to understand the circumstances behind that being allowed to happen. And I would tell you that in most cases, there's not near enough attention given to that. And in these cases where, and again, this has happened a lot in the last two or three years, the interest rate increases just suck the oxygen right out of the transaction in terms of partner distributions. And you know, I would suggest that in every deal I've looked at that had that happen, the lead partner had already taken significant distributions, and I didn't see those being put back into the deal. Now, they may have been in some circumstances, but, you know, bottom line is far too many of them did not have that happen. And yet, I watch syndicators that have had these issues. There's one of the more highly regarded syndicators, at least in the Houston market, very much lauded over the years for his success. And I'm not sure how many transactions he had go under in the last two or three years, but there was at least one that I know for sure, and I think there may have been a couple others. And yet, with very carefully worded email, they're out raising money again, and they make it sound like, gee, we're creating incredible returns over a long period of time. I believe it's a 10-year forward look, and I would tell you, man, that is the last thing I would do. Look at the last 10 years and see what their performance has been, and make sure they're including the deals that went under. I have a feeling they may not be, but it's amazing to me how little ability you have. If you don't know the players in the industry and you don't have any kind of history with them, where you've been watching this arena of investing for a long time, you won't know the better. And there's nobody out there. There's no there is an SEC, but the rules that govern this space, the crowdfunding space, are very, very thin. But there's no list you can go look at to see who had a deal go under. And, you know, provided they dotted their I's and crossed their T's, they likely didn't violate any of the securities laws. They may have, but I'm just saying generally syndicators today, if they're using some of the better attorneys, they've managed to stay clear. And I will be the first to tell you that just because they had a deal go south doesn't indicate, you know, a crime occurred or fraud. And so I don't want to make it sound like that. But you would think that if someone's being transparent with you, they would give you both the good and the bad. And in fact, I like seeing a syndicator that's had some hardship, because I know life is full of hardship. And if somebody's acting like they've never had any hardship in the syndication space, that just means they hadn't been in it very long, or they haven't had it yet. That's really what that means, because it's going to happen. The real estate market does have cycles. I know I hear others on the radio act like, you know, it doesn't matter whether the market's up or down, we're always going to make money, and that's just a bunch of hot air. That's not the case. We, meaning the guru that's selling the memberships, may make money, but you as the investor can lose every dollar you have in a deal. And I've seen it happen more than I care to remember. And usually there's a good economic reason that it happened. It's not, in most cases that I'm aware of, firsthand knowledge of, there was no fraud involved, but that doesn't really taste any better. And just because there's fraud involved, if there's fraud involved, we've got another situation in Houston going on with one of the mentor groups that is dancing through some litigation, I believe. I think it's gotten to that stage. And their investors were very dissatisfied with how money was spent, made all sorts of allegations about nefarious activity. And so that stuff's out there, and you won't know it. When you get the next email that group, as a matter of fact, sends out, you would think that they were God's gift to passive real estate investors. You know, here we got another chance for you to invest money with us. And I would just tell you, you really need to look around, get involved with some other groups besides the one that you're thinking of investing with or through, and see what other people know. It would be unusual if you wouldn't find, I mean, if you get to be friends with enough people in these groups, they talk, and you'd be amazed at the web of connected investors. And again, you know, we've worked in this space long enough to where we can try to help you avoid stepping into a mousetrap where, you know, it's just a question of you not knowing. Otherwise, you wouldn't even be interested in looking at the transaction. So anyway, again, if you want to chat about these types of things before you get started investing, that you want to use your money in your IRA so you don't have to pay tax to access those funds, we can help you do that. It's not a requirement that you pay the tax to be able to get access to those funds. Don't let anybody tell you that. You can control your funds. You can even, in some cases, pay yourself from those funds, and you can invest for quite a while where the tax dollars that you would have sent to the IRS can be put into additional future transactions. And even the tax laws themselves offer an incredible a combination of strategies where we can use the Roth form of retirement account, whether it's an IRA or it's a 401, also known as a solo K, to where you can absolutely fully exploit the tax rules for investing in real estate period. Not just invest in your retirement funds. You can invest in real estate in the best possible form, entity type, etc., by using your rollovers from your 401 or IRA accounts. And we've done it many times. We can discuss with you how you might achieve that, and you will control your money. Those will be self-directed options to where you control the money. You decide who, when, where, and how much to invest in, and you can decide whether to pay yourself occasionally. And don't be misled. Don't fall for the, oh, you need to rip the Band-Aid off and pay 40 to 50% of your net worth in tax to the IRS, and then you'll be done with the man. You won't have to worry about taxes. There's nothing further from the reality. You will never be done with taxes if you don't get your taxes into tax-free, not tax-deferred. I heard a comment on the radio the other day, I believe it was Self-Made Millionaires program, or maybe it was a YouTube video that he had done, where he made the comment, they were talking about how we defer, and then we get to the end of life, and we get a step up in basis, which is true, we do, to a certain extent, but you're not going to do that defer through the 1031 exchange that they will mention when you go take their workshop. And again, good workshop, good program. It's just the information is not entirely accurate, or it's confusing at best. But I'll suggest to you that the 1031 exchange option is for a small partnership where everyone is staying together to go into the next phase or the next transaction, next acquisition. When you've got 150 partners and a $98 million capital raise that's buying a 400 unit or 500 unit class B plus or maybe A minus property, you're not going to execute a 1031 exchange, because a lot of people want to get their money back and maybe go a different direction. And then there's also rules that aren't well defined, but there's court cases that restrict how much money can be taken out at certain times before you do the 1031 and after. Don't ever hear that discussed when you attend those workshops. So just be careful and get tax advice from someone that's in the tax advice business. As Red Adair used to say, the famous Houston oil and gas well firefighter, who's passed on at this point, he used to have an expression that if you think professionals are expensive, just try the amateurs. And I think about that every time I have a call, and it's from somebody that joined the aforementioned platform, usually, because they are very successful at getting members. And again, there's reasons. There are reasons to join that program where there are options available to you that, if, for instance, if you're not an accredited investor, that group mandates, I believe it's still true, that they mandate all their transactions that the lead partners that they're allowing to undertake transactions have to offer it under the 506B category of offerings under the crowdfunding statute, which basically allows up to 35 non-accredited investors. That's those with less than $1 million net worth, or they earn less than $200,000 to $300,000 a year for 3 years. But anyway, that platform mandates that the lead partners have to allow those transactions under a 506B offering versus 506C, which is for accredited investors only. So again, I can give you some other reasons. I still would tell you that of the programs, particularly in the Houston area and Dallas, that program has value to the right people. It's just you got to know where to slice the fat off, I guess you might say, and keep from falling prey to the bad advice. And if there's any discussion at all about retirement funds, I would suggest to you, you tune it out. I will answer your questions free of charge on that topic if you will set up a call with me. Happy to keep your money in your pocket instead of the IRS's. Last time I checked, the IRS doesn't pay a very good rate of return on the money that you send into them. Now, do they? Doesn't take a guru to understand that concept. And so I'm telling you, don't fall for it. Okay, well, we're at our halfway point. Let's go ahead and take a break, and we will circle back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control and make the
okay, welcome back to the final segment of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And I wanted to turn now to discuss the good, the bad, and the ugly in the one big, beautiful bill that Congress has moved along. I believe it's been passed in the House, and now the Senate will take up discussion as part of the reconciliation process, and it's not going to be easy, is what we're hearing from the Senate. But, you know, Mr. Trump has a way of bringing people to the table. I guess some would say making them heal. as I do my, well, as I try to do with my Pomeranian at times, and he's not big on complying with that healing request. And what I've learned is, and I'm sure those of you that have pets will appreciate it, I've learned that if a dog is not motivated by food, meaning snacks, they're not going to be a good trainee. They won't be a hard worker. And I know we've got a little dog group. I may have mentioned this before here in our subdivision overseas, where we meet every day at about 5 o'clock for the dogs to continue the socialization process. We've got the only, probably most of the only 7 dogs in that are in our development that won't growl or kill each other. And it's really interesting. I've watched my dog, I mean, he had very little socialization with other dogs until we started doing this a while back, and it's amazing to watch how he has developed. However, he doesn't care about food. Yeah, he's the perfect size. He's the perfect specimen. He's not a canine. He's a creature. He's a HISO dog. And I shouldn't say even the word dog. He's a creature. He's just amazing. But he's not one to learn, other than he's got a very good intellect and he does remember things very well when he wants to. And in any event, Mr. Trump has a way, as I was saying, with getting people to come to agreement. And, you know, it can be a promise to support him in the next primary, or I suppose he's got some ability to have the RNC provide some funding. But in any event, let's talk about some of the provisions in this bill. And, you know, I'm going to refer to an article that the Tax Foundation issued just within the last week, I believe. And it's not a long article, but it goes right to the point of what the good, the bad, and the ugly is. And let's start with talking about the good. The bill makes some smart tax cuts and revenue increases. Now, I'm going to say the Tax Foundation they're fairly bipartisan, but, you know, again, I've seen a lot of things they say that, well, of course, anytime you're talking about taxes, what's good for the goose may be bad for the gander, and so it depends on who's casting the aspersions as to whether or not it's good or bad. But anyway, most of the good tax policy aligns with Tax Foundation's principle of stability. That's what they're saying about themselves. It permanently extends the rates and brackets of the 2017 individual tax cuts. This provides certainty for households and stability to this portion of the tax code. And, you know, you hear the politicians refer to the fact that if the Democrats don't get involved and support this big, beautiful bill, or anybody else, that could apply to the Senate, that effectively they're putting a tax increase in place, because those brackets and rates are going to go back to what they were pre-2017, or actually I guess it would be 2018 was the first tax year affected. And so they make it sound like, oh, they're voting to raise taxes. They don't make it sound like they're voting to keep provisions that were passed back in 2017 with the intention that they sunset, go away, unless Congress takes action. So be clear, nobody's going to be taking a vote to increase the rates or the brackets, as the case may be. So let's see. Next, the bill permanently extends the larger deduction and the alternative minimum tax threshold that were only temporary in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. These two provisions have greatly simplified the tax code for millions of taxpayers, and that's a true statement. I mean, I'm amazed at how many of our client base now just takes the standard deduction because it's so high. And, you know, it's amazing when I look at the history on some of our clients. Every time I see one that's taking the standard, I look back at prior year or two just to see, well, where were they at there? And of course, they were always over the threshold and were claiming actual. So that's a good thing. And by the way, permanently, in both cases, on the rates and brackets and on the standard deduction, means that it will take new legislation to change. There won't have to be a vote to keep it in place. It will be in place until it's effectively changed with new legislation. Lawmakers also provided a permanently higher threshold for expensing certain equipment for smaller businesses and investment amounts. That's good news for business. Regarding estate and gift tax provisions, the bill institutes a permanent and inflation-adjusted exemption level of $15 million beginning in 2026, which further enhances stability, which that's definitely a good thing. We want to know that we've got a planning runway, so to speak, for a lengthy runway for executing whatever strategies you and your advisors have agreed to. Let's see. The bill provides a degree of certainty and stability in the international tax code while removing the threat of substantially higher taxes at the end of this year, that's 2025, for the U.S.-based multinational companies by permanently extending a slightly less generous version of current policy for the international regime. And these, I'm really getting into the woods, but or the weeds, but GILTI, ED, or FDII, and BEAT, those are acronyms for several of the tax regimes that we have under the code. And I doubt seriously there's anyone listening to this show that has a clue what that is or wants to know what it is. If you do, if anybody does, you can either go Google it or send me an email and I'll pull some info that I think is a pretty succinct summary of each. Moving away from some of the permanent changes, the bill makes improvements to cost recovery. Read that as depreciation for U.S. businesses relative to current law from 2025 to 2029. The bill reintroduces expensing for investment in equipment and other short-lived assets and domestic research and development. As a new policy, certain qualified structures are eligible for expensing. The TCJA's less restrictive limitation on interest deductions is also brought back. These are important policies that would greatly increase business investment and the economic benefits of the bill if they were made permanent. And I don't know, I haven't dug in on that yet, but for most of my clients that are in these real estate private partnerships, I think they're referring to the amount, if any. A lot of partnerships don't have it, others do. If you look at your K-1, line 13K is defined as excess business interest expense. And if there's an amount on that line, and again, there's not in many cases, then the partnership is limited in the amount of interest expense it can pass through to its partners. And it's not to say that you'll lose it. You won't get to claim it in the current year, and you may not ever get to claim it. Depends on over the life of the partnership, whether you have any years where the excess business income, which on real estate partnerships is not likely, but if you did have that, you'd be able to write it off. Or when you get to the end, if you have a gain on disposition that's adequate, you would get to recoup via an adjustment to your basis the amounts that you were carrying forward. And I think that means that this will go back to the old policy. I may be wrong. I need to confirm what they're referring to when they talk about the TCJA's less restrictive limitation on interest deductions. But I think that's what it is. The bill also has some good policies that raise revenue relative to current law by reducing some of the tax code's many tax credits, deductions, and other preferences. The largest area of reform is the Inflation Reduction Act's green energy tax credits. The bill raises about $500 billion over a decade, reducing the cost of those credits by about half. Several IRA credits, and that's Inflation Reduction Act, that is not individual retirement account. This was a very much a sleight of hand that the prior administration did, trying to make things seem like something they weren't, you know. But anyway, several IRA credits are also repealed, like those for electric vehicles and residential energy products, which are expensive and ineffective, while most of the others are restricted or phased out quicker. However, the bill expands and extends the Clean Fuel Production Tax Credit and introduces additional compliance challenges for many of the credits. Health insurance premium tax credits projected to cost about $1 trillion. That's $1 trillion over the next decade, are pared back about 20% by tightening eligibility rules and reducing improper payments. The bill also tightens some of the tax-exempt rules, such as for unrelated business income. And I don't know the details on that, but I'll tell you, if you're invested with your IRA in a real estate private partnership syndication, if there's debt involved, which there always will be, there's a category of unrelated business income that is referred to as the unrelated debt financed income that is taxable from your partnerships. And I know that may come as a surprise to some of you people that aren't my clients, because we explain it to our clients. But if you're using your retirement funds and they're not in a Roth, it's another reason to convert to Roth, as I've indicated many times before. If you have positive taxable income, and I don't mean cash flow, I mean positive taxable income, then you may, and I underscore may because there are a few exceptions, and it depends on how much it is, you may owe tax on your IRA account. And that even applies to Roth IRAs. Doesn't apply to the 401, the self-directed 401, aka Solo K. The 401s are exempt from that UDFI tax under section, I believe it's IRC 514C9, if I recall. Maybe has a small Roman numeral 4 under that 9s, but 514C9 generally. And if you want to read about that, maybe you want to fall asleep early some evening, pull out your copy of the Internal Revenue Code. Oh, I know y'all have that. It's got to be there, right next to your Bible on your nightstand, no doubt. But if it's not, you can jump online, and you'll end up at the Cornell University site that has the code and the regs on it. They're live, living color. And when you read, when you start in the section 512, it explains that generally for IRAs, the income earned by an IRA generally is exempt from tax. Well, most people that have IRAs stopped reading at that point and didn't read any further, or they would understand that, oh, there are situations that will create tax. And one of those situations involves real estate. And this at some point moves over to section 514. I forget exactly where it breaks, but it starts off saying no tax. I think that gets down to the end of section 512. Then 514 raises the ugly head of the unrelated debt financed income tax. And then 514C9 is where you'll find an exemption for real estate earned by trust pursuant to section 401. Bottom line is, if you're using a self-directed 401 trust, which is what we prefer for those that qualify, then you are exempt from the UDFI. And if you have questions about that, ask away. Let me know, because the last thing you want is to recognize a big gain along the way on one of these partnerships and you don't pick it up, because the IRS is going after those types of returns. You have to understand the K-1 that you get has all the information in it that would show the likelihood that maybe a certain IRA would owe that tax. So it's not like it's hidden. So anyway, let's keep moving here. We're going to run out of time before we get through the bad and the ugly. The bill also, last good here, or last couple goods, the bill also permanently extends some of the TCJA's limits on some itemized deductions, such as for mortgage interest, and limits each dollar of itemized deductions for top earners. However, the bill waters down the TCJA's $10,000 cap on deductions for state and local taxes. That would be the SALT acronym that you've no doubt seen in the news, raising it to $40,000 for taxpayers earning less than $500,000. That is good news. Okay, the bad. Rather than making the most pro-growth features permanent, the bill spends far too much money on political gimmicks and carve-outs, resulting in a package that provides a modest boost to the economy, but at a huge fiscal cost. It introduces tax exemptions for overtime pay and tips, as well as the deduction for auto loan interest and a new standard deduction available for all seniors, all of which violate basic tax principles of treating taxpayers equally. Well, that's, you can say that if you want. I think I can show you many other examples where that's not necessarily a basic tax principle. Combined, these four provisions cost about $300 billion over the next 4 years they're in effect, and if eventually extended beyond that date, the cost would more than double over the next decade. So I'm assuming that's because of our aging population, maybe. I'm not sure. Complicated eligibility requirements reduce the cost somewhat, but it would be better to not introduce these bad ideas in the first place, says the Tax Foundation. Another costly mistake is the route lawmakers have taken on the treatment of non-corporate businesses. In 2017, lawmakers introduced a 20% deduction for business income that is taxed on the individual rate schedule and not at the corporate tax rate of 21%. Taxes on dividends and capital gains are a second layer of tax on corporate income. The non-corporate businesses, also known as pass-throughs, face a few changes in the bill, but the main change is that the deduction is made permanent and increased to 23%. I don't know. That sounds like good news to those of us that are self-employed. But anyway, the cost of that change is $700 billion over the next decade. This will further decrease the effective tax rates that pass-throughs face on their income relative to corporate profits, making the code less neutral with respect to its business form. Unfortunately, lawmakers chose these cuts over more effective measures to grow the economy, such as permanence for the business cost recovery provisions. We estimate that making permanent 100% bonus depreciation, expensing for domestic R&D and qualified structures, and the TCJA's less restrictive interest limitation would more than double the growth impact of the bill, resulting in an increase in long-run GDP of 1.6%. I don't disagree. I wish we could do both the 20% pass-through, or 23 now, and 100% bonus depreciation, because that has been one of the biggest stimulants to our industry, real estate. Let's see. Lawmakers could have reduced the cost of the bill, blah, blah, blah. Let's go on with the ugly, because I've got 1 minute left. Or maybe 2 minutes. The bill further complicates the tax code in several ways, sending taxpayers through a maze of new rules and compliance costs. This is the ugly. What's new? New compliance hurdles that in many cases the compliance itself outweighs any potential tax benefit. Well, that's nothing new. That's been the case since 1986. No tax on tips, overtime, and car loans comes with various conditions and guardrails that, if enacted, will likely require hundreds of pages of IRS guidance to interpret. That changes, or the changes to the IRA credits, while commendable in many ways, keep in place some of the most complicated rules. So, nothing new on that front. Let's see what else is notable. Well, most of the rest of the ugly is not something that I think is going to be widely felt. I think, you know, some tax-exempt entities have some changes. 529 accounts are against some minor changes, involve penalties for certain uses, etc. Well, we're down to a minute, so let me just say thank you for tuning in. And we'll be back on Sunday, 7 a.m., right here on AM 700, KSEV, the voice of Texas. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.